From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
Hit it.
How you feel, brother?
As the new film about James Brown, Get On Up, opens in theaters, we listen back to interviews with the Godfather of Soul himself and musicians Maceo Parker.
He always liked to have a heavy one. That was his style. Go on and have a funky good time. That's where the one is, like right there.
And Bootsy Collins, who said Brown's dress code for the band was out of step with the times.
The peace, the love, that was going on. And, you know, here we are getting stuck with wearing suits and patent leather shoes, you know.
We'll also hear from Bruce Tucker, who collaborated on Brown's autobiography. And David Edelstein reviews the latest mega-budget Marvel Comics picture, Guardians of the Galaxy. He says it's light, funny, even hilarious. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, with today's show devoted to James Brown. Tell me what you gonna do. I got to know about that. Is your love for real? Do you know how I feel? Tell me what you gonna do. Yeah, about that. I got ants in my pants and I need to dance. Come on. He was called the Godfather of Soul, but it's impossible to imagine funk or even hip-hop without the rhythmic innovations of James Brown. As a singer, bandleader, and performer, he influenced generations of musicians around the world. And even though he died in 2006 at age 73, James Brown continues to be influential. A new movie about him, called Get On Up, premieres in theaters today. Later in the show, we'll hear from his biographer and from two musicians who played in his band, Maceo Parker and Bootsy Collins. But first, an interview with James Brown himself, which Terry recorded in 2005, after the publication of his autobiography, I Feel Good. The man needs no introduction, but here's a great one.
So now, ladies and gentlemen, it is start time. Are you ready for start time? Thank you, and thank you very kindly. It is indeed a great pleasure to present to you at this particular time, national and international known as the hardest working man in show business, man that's saying, I'll go crazy. Try me. You've got the power. Think. If you want me, I don't mind. Bewildered. $1 million seller, lost someone. The very latest release, Night Train. Let's everybody shout and shimmy. Mr. Dynamite, the amazing Mr. Please Please himself, the star of the show, James Brown and the Famous Flame.
Now, we've all heard your MC introduce you over the years. Why did you want an MC to introduce you in this fantastic way?
Well, because it's dramatic, it dramatizes a lot, and it's a build-up what show business should be about. It should be the great fanfare and a production, same as a minister would do in a church, or a coach would do to his team. You have to have a way of getting started, and that's probably the best way that I know of, with a dramatic introduction.
And one of the things your MC has always done is, like, put on your cape, take off your cape. Now, have you always had your clothes made for you?
Most of the time I design them. I started wearing red suits years ago and they thought we were crazy. But we wanted people to say, there he is, not where he is. And the same thing applied to the Famous Flames.
I want to play I Got You, I Feel Good, one of your most famous songs. You have two versions of this. The first one you didn't release. You weren't happy with it. This was in 1964. What was wrong with the original version? What made you think it's not ready yet? It's not right yet?
You got to get it where it syncs with the people or where they're at, you know. I recorded I Feel Good in Chicago, and it was too sharp, too slick. Had a baritone, you know, and it was like, I feel good. Da 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 da. We call that staccato because it hits right on all the points. Da 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 da. In the drum. So what we did, we want to get more of a funk feeling, a sanctified feeling. So we changed it and slowed it down. Wow, I feel good. Da 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 da. Then that's two different kind of things. See, that's one is jazz because sharp mixes, and the other one kind of laid back, and gave you a little rock and roll feeling at that time as well. We went with the laid back cut because that fit the street and fit the dances. A good thing I could dance, because by being able to dance, I could really tell that the new arrangement, the new concept I had for it, really fell right in place.
What was the difference between the dancing you could do with the second version compared to the first?
Well, you could do the street dances. The first verse was, you might even do ballroom and everything with it, but the second verse was strictly for get down from the street.
Right.
And we need street action. That's what's basically wrong with the music there. A lot of it don't go street.
Okay, well, let's hear both of these versions back to back, the unreleased and the released versions of James Brown, I Got You, I Feel Good.
Well, you'll notice that the unreleased has a baritone in it, mm-hmm, with a heavy sound, and the other one don't have the baritone, but you'll see the difference.
Let's hear it.
Oh, I feel good. I knew that I would not. I feel good. I knew that I would now. So good, so good. I got it. Ah, I feel nice. Sugar and spice. I feel nice. Sugar and spice. So nice, so nice. Since I got it. I feel nice, like sugar and spice. So nice, so nice, that I got it here. Wow, I feel good. I knew that I would not. I feel good. I knew that I would.
Well, shortly after you recorded I Got You, you recorded Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. And I want to quote something that you say in your new memoir, I Feel Good. You say, Papa's Got a Brand New Bag changed everything again for me and my music. I didn't need melody to make music. That was, to me, old-fashioned and out of step. I now realized I could compose and sing a song that used one chord or two at the most. How did you start reducing your songs to being more about rhythm than about melody?
Well, there's a lot of my songs that's melody, but like I Feel Good, that's melody, all that stuff. But rhythm all the way through the song, and I was listening to, but I went with more of a jazz concept gospel situation.
Now, at about this time, your beat really starts shifting from the two and the four to the one and the three. Can you talk a little bit about that shift?
Started,
yeah, go ahead.
It started that with Papa's Bag.
Right.
From that point on, it was one and three. And even before I Feel Good, Papa's Bag has a one and three.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe just clap for us the difference?
Well, one is laid back, and it's about ding-a-ding-a-bum. The one has syncopation. I mean, that's the difference. And you count it off, you right on the one. Bam, doom, bang, bang. And then the other one, you say one and a two, and you'd be on a two, see. But with two is the upbeat, and I'm on the downbeat. That's the difference.
And was it hard to convince the musicians that this would work, or did they get it right away?
No, I paid them. And they played with it, and they played what I wanted, and that was it, because they would have never agreed.
They would have never agreed to it?
They would have never agreed.
Why not?
Well, because it was in their head that Mozart, Schubert, Beethoven, Strauss, Bach, Chopin was correct. And they used to tell me that I was wrong. So they thought that was a law in music. There's no law in music. There's a freedom in music.
Some of the musicians in your band became famous in their own right later on. Maceo Parker, Fred Wesley, Bootsy Collins. And you know, I interviewed Bootsy Collins a few years ago, and one of the things he said, I mean, he loved playing in your band, but one of the things he said is that it was hard for him to be so disciplined. It was around 1970, the era when you were recording Sex Machine, and he said, you know, everyone was freaking out, but we were standing up there being the tightest band in the land, having to wear suits and patent leather shoes, and you couldn't jump out in the audience and freak out and act crazy, and that's what we wanted to do. Did you know that someone like, say, Bootsy Collins really wanted to, like, be wild and crazy, and you wanted this really tight, disciplined band?
Well, I taught them organization. They didn't have organization. And discipline is very important. You wouldn't take, you know, I want them where they could play at West Point as well as play in the street on the corner. I mean West Point or Navy Academy place. I want them to be able to go anywhere. And see, when I went to play Papa's Bag and stuff like that, I could play for the president, then I'd go and play for the people in the street.
Now, do you ever find musicians? I know you used to find musicians, didn't you?
Oh, yes. I'll do it now, but, you know, the musicians now, they have a lot more respect, and they're more intense on doing right.
So, Mr. Brown, what are some of the things you find musicians for back in the day?
Oh, a lot of major things. I did a total program, like a West Point. They got to be clean, neat. The shirt got to be pressed. Shoes got to be shine. The suit got to be pressed. They got to play correct. They can't be looking off when they should be watching me, because then they miss something, I find them. Those people would rather not get fined, so they have a little bit more discipline. And that's in every situation. I'm sure the President of the United States has ways of making people account for themselves.
What's the biggest fine you ever gave?
I don't know. Maybe 500.
We'll hear more of our 2005 interview with James Brown in the second half of the show. Coming up, an interview with Bruce Tucker, who collaborated with Brown on his 1986 autobiography. This is Fresh Air. We're paying tribute to James Brown on this edition of Fresh Air. Bruce Tucker co-authored Brown's 1986 autobiography, The Godfather of Soul. Tucker is a white writer who was teaching a course at Fisk University on the autobiographies of black musicians when he realized there was a big gap. James Brown hadn't written his story. Tucker convinced Brown to write an autobiography and became Brown's collaborator. I spoke with Tucker in 1990 after a new edition was published.
Well, let's listen to the first hit that he had, and this is from 1956. The record was Please, Please, Please. Would you like to say something about this?
Well, this is James's first record. He recorded a demo of it in a Macon radio station, and it eventually got to King Records in Cincinnati, and he went up there, and the Famous Flames went with him, and they cut it, and it was a hit. It was a big hit.
Please, 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 please.
James Brown, Please, 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 recorded in 1956, and my guest Bruce Tucker wrote James Brown's autobiography with him. Fill us in a little bit about his background. He came from a really poor background.
Yes, he was born out in the woods in South Carolina and moved into Augusta, Georgia, which was a wide-open serviceman's town in the late 30s, early 40s. Lived in a brothel with an aunt named Honey Washington. They sold moonshine whiskey in addition to the other activities that went on in that house. Eventually, the house was closed down by the police. James then, as a pre-teenager, I guess you would say, began getting into trouble here and there. He broke into some unlocked cars to steal some clothes, got caught, and was sentenced to 8 to 16 years in prison for breaking into unlocked cars. again, another extremely harsh sentence. He served only 3 of those years. He wrote a letter to the parole board saying that he wanted to get out and sing gospel for the Lord. He was known as Music Box in prison because of his singing. He got out, formed the group, and then about 6 years later, there came Please, 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 and then after that, he conquered the Apollo Theater in New York and went on from there to become the superstar that he remains.
My guest is Bruce Tucker, who wrote with James Brown the book James Brown, the Godfather of Soul. And as you say, James Brown is really the godfather of funk. And the turning point for him in terms of starting to play funk was his 1965 record, Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. What was different about this record, and what did James Brown have to tell you about it?
The difference in funk is that all of the rhythmic emphasis is on the one, is on that first downbeat at the beginning of a measure. And it really drives the music forward. You can hear it in this song, in Embryo, and then in later work quite clearly. And the other thing is the polyrhythmic complexity, which is what James is known for. The other thing I think worth noting about this record is the date. In 1965, James was already leaving soul behind for funk. I mean, it's an amazingly revolutionary record if you put it in historical perspective like that.
I really like something he said to you about this record. He said that he discovered his strength wasn't in the horns, it was in the rhythm. He said he was hearing everything, even the guitars, like they were drums.
Exactly, yes, and I think that is the key to funk and the key to James Brown. Everything is used percussively, the voices, the guitars, the drums. He carried 2 and sometimes 3 drummers during this period on the road. Yes, everything is used percussively. I think one of the difficulties in making the case for musicians like James Brown for their importance is that Western music theory downgrades things that aren't important in European classical music, such as rhythm. And so there's no means of adequately notating it or so forth, or appreciating it. And so we're, in a sense, trained not to hear it. But it's there, and that's James's great, great achievement.
Kind of a riddle to me politically. I mean, he had that really big and really influential record, Say It Loud and Black and I'm Proud in 1968. He had supported H. Rapp Brown. At the same time, though, he supported Richard Nixon and played at Richard Nixon's inaugural. Can you help reconcile those two different political parts of James Brown?
Well, it's difficult to reconcile the parts of James Brown because I think James Brown is deeply ambivalent about a great many things, and I think it shows up in precisely those kinds of oppositions that you set up. He gave money to the H. Rapp Brown Defense Fund. He also bought a lifetime membership in the NAACP. He was a great admirer of Dr. Martin Luther King, and he's very close to Reverend Al Sharpton. He made a record that was almost contemporaneous with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, called America is My Home, for which he took a great deal of heat from a great many people. So I think that there's a deep contradiction in him, and I think it's difficult to reconcile. I think it's difficult for him to reconcile because this country has greatly rewarded him and viciously punished him throughout his life, beginning from the time he was a child and right up to the present. The song Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, which appeared in 68, of course, cost him his crossover audience. People became afraid to come to his concerts and so forth. And if you listen to the song, of course, what you immediately notice is that it's almost a children's song. There's a children's chorus on there singing the refrain.
Bruce Tucker speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. He collaborated on the 1986 James Brown autobiography, The Godfather of Soul. More about James Brown in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, connecting consumers directly to its online marketplace of services from member-reviewed local companies. More at angieslist.com. From the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of NPR journalists all around the world whose stories take us there every day. And from Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. This is NPR. Ow!
Coming up, we'll hear from some of the musicians who played with James Brown, saxophonist Maceo Parker and bass player Bootsy Collins. And David Edelstein reviews Guardians of the Galaxy, the new Marvel Comics film starring Chris Pratt and the voices of Vin Diesel and Bradley Cooper. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross, back with more of today's James Brown Show. A new movie about him called Get On Up opens today in theaters. Next, we're going to hear Terry's 1989 interview with a longtime James Brown band member, saxophonist Maceo Parker. Parker also has played with funksters George Clinton and Bootsy Collins, as well as the JB All-Stars. Here's Maceo Parker with James Brown in 1969.
Sometime I'll be alone. I call another brother. Talking about Maceo. Maceo. Blow your horn. I don't want no trash. Play me some popcorn.
walk.
Maceo Parker joined James Brown's band in 1964 and played with Brown for most of the 60s and part of the 70s and 80s. I spoke with Parker in 1990 and asked about the discipline James Brown demanded of the band.
You know, you got to be on time. You got to have your uniforms and stuff got to be intact. You got to have the bow tie. You can't come up without the bow tie. You can't come up without the cummerbund. Your shoes got to be... your patent leather shoes we wearing at the time. Got to be greased. You know, you just got to have this stuff. This is what I expect. And that was okay.
Did you get to, if you left the band, did you get to keep the costume?
No. He bought the costumes, he bought the shoes. And for some reason, if you decide to leave the group, please leave, my uniforms with somebody.
When James Brown started playing funk, he started putting the accent on the first beat. When did he start telling you about the one in his music and putting the emphasis on the one?
He always liked to have a heavy one. That's what he felt. That was his style. Gonna have a funky good time. That's where the one is, like right there.
Was it hard for you to pick up on that, or did it seem natural?
It was hard when I had to solo, in that I'm used to hearing the accented beat being on two. Like, if I would have done it, it would be gonna have a funky good time. Two and three and four. That's not normally how everybody was recording, and you could hear easily. I think their ear is easy to hear two and four, and that's where you clap. That's where the backbeat is normally.
Right.
You know, ting to tat, ting to tat, like that, two and four. But this was one. It was, and at first, like I said, at first it was a little awkward. But we became used to it.
Hit it. How you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good.
Ain't so much bone, brother. How you feel, man? Your name, I don't want no people to know you're in here.
Yeah.
How you feel, fella? Hey, yeah. Jam! Sure getting down. Look at him! Ha. We're gonna have a funk good time. 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 Let's take him up, Fred.
Is it hard work working for the hardest working man in show business?
It was hard, but it was rewarding and it was fun because, you know, you're working with somebody who has this title, hardest working man in show business. That means you got to do your part. You got to keep up. And, you never want him to say, hey, man, you know, if I can do 10, 15 splits a night, you know, at least you guys can do, play the little vamp or whatever it is, you know, for 45 minutes.
When you kiss me, though, and you miss me, you hold me tight, make everything all right. I make up in a cold sweat. Come on.
Saxophonist Maceo Parker with James Brown. Coming up, bass player Bootsy Collins talks about his experiences in James Brown's band. This is Fresh Air. The super heavy bass line in James Brown's 1970 hit Sex Machine was supplied by Bootsy Collins. Bootsy continued to push funk in new directions, teaming up in the mid-70s with George Clinton in Parliament Funkadelic, which combined funk with science fiction and psychedelia. Then he formed the spin-off group, Bootsy's Rubber Band, that was focused on his colorful stage persona. I spoke with Bootsy Collins in 1994. Here he is with James Brown in 1970.
Watch me, I got it. Watch me, I got it. Hey, I got something that makes me want to shout. I got something that tells me what it's all about. I got soul and I'm super bad. I got soul and I'm super bad. Got a move that tells me what to do. Sometimes it's deep. Now I got a move that tells me what to do. Sometimes I feel so nice, I wanna try myself a few. I got soul and I'm super bad.
Well, listen, I went back to James Brown's autobiography to see what he had to say about you.
Yeah. Oh, God.
So he writes, I think Bootsy learned a lot from me. When I met him, he was playing a lot of bass.
Yeah.
The ifs, ands, and the buts.
Yeah, he's right.
I got him to see the importance of the one in funk.
Yeah.
The downbeat at the beginning of every bar.
That's right.
I got him to key in on the dynamic parts of the one.
That's right.
Instead of playing all around it.
Yeah.
Then he could do all of his stuff in the right places after the one.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, absolutely correct.
No, was it hard to make the adjustment to playing on the one?
No, because I knew he knew something. I mean, you know, you know, and I was there to learn. It wasn't like, you know, this is my party and I'll fly if I want to. I knew it was James's party, you know, and whatever he knew, I wanted to find out because, you know, he just had this, the band was the tightest band in the land and he had this thing going on. We wanted to find out what the heck it was, you know.
Now, had you been playing on the 2 and 4 before?
I started playing on the, with a guitar, and I wasn't actually a bass player yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I was learning to play bass, you know, and I wanted to play bass. So it was like all those other ifs, ands, and buts is what I was playing when I picked up the bass, you know. It was like, oh, you mean I got to play on the dominant note? Oh, okay. So it was like all brand new to me, you know, and I just didn't feel like a normal bass player, you know, so... But by James telling me that, it all kind of made sense. And once I started hearing it, you know, what was actually happening when I did that, it was like, oh, and then I can still do this and I can still do that. So it was a groove. It was really a groove.
And let me play one of the recordings you made with James Brown. Why don't we hear Sex Machine? And do you want to say anything about the rhythm you're playing on this?
That's pretty much the whole rhythm is what I figure I've been doing ever since. When you hear Sex Machine, that's pretty much where I'm at now.
Okay, here we go.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing.
Go ahead.
I want to get into it, man, you know.
Go ahead.
Like a sex machine, man.
Yeah.
Moving, doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Can I count it off?
Go ahead.
1, 2, 3, 4. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene. Machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
I like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Wait a minute. Shake your arm. Then use your palm. Stay on the scene. I like a sex machine. You got to have the feeling. Sure as your bone.
get it together. Right on, right on. Get up,
get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
My guest is Bootsy Collins. Now, tell me how your image changed when you started playing with James Brown. What you did on stage, what you wore on stage.
Ooh, that's good. That's good. What I wore on stage. Oh, man. Well, as you know, I may not know. Those were the days like in the 60s, getting ready to go into the 70s. But, you know, it was another kind of movement going on. And kids were like coming up front and wearing like bleached jeans and T-shirts and afros and, you know, the granny glasses. And, you know, we was all freaking out. We was having a freaking party, you know. And I don't know, then here we are. We're playing with James Brown, and, you know, we're in the Army now. You know, it's like, whoa. You know, so it's like, but it was good for the fact that it kind of brought us off of the street. We were out there doing what everybody else was doing, acting crazy, throwing firebombs and doing everything, you know. So getting with James kind of brought us off of the street. And, you know, I think we kind of realized that, and at the same time, you know, it gave us the opportunity of really doing something that we wanted to do. So, you know, we kind of put everything else in the back seat because this is what we wanted to do. Even though, you know, we wanted to dress crazy. We didn't know how crazy we wanted to dress, but we didn't want to wear suits. You know, we knew that. You know?
So you were wearing matching suits on stage while everybody else was wearing jeans and tie-dye T-shirts?
Yeah, while this movement was going on, the peace, the love, that was going on. And, you know, here we are, you know, getting stuck with wearing suits and patent leather shoes, you know. And but at that time, you know, it was the start of it, so it was cool, you know. We said, well, we'll eat this because, you know, we definitely, you know, want to be with James, you know. So if you want to be with James, that's what you had to do.
Bass player Bootsy Collins speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. Get On Up, a new biopic about James Brown, opens in theaters today. To wrap up our salute to James Brown, let's hear a little more from the Godfather of Soul himself, whom Terry interviewed in 2005.
You know, pop songs have always been about love and sex, but they never really used the word sex before in the lyrics, I think. What made you decide to actually use the word sex in Sex Machine?
Well, sex, I don't know, if you're not far from it with the dancing and all that stuff, and the emulation that they do when they get on the floor, whether it's ballroom, two-stepping, the Funky Chicken, or James Brown, or all these different things. And that's what's in your mind if you go by a pool and see young ladies out there in the bathing suits, swimsuits, because the men don't draw them, the women do. I would use that term because we was at this dance. I mean, the fellas, girls at this dance. And she was just sitting there, and he's sitting there, nobody doing anything, almost like wallflowers. So the fellow jumped up and said, get up. I feel like being like a sex machine. And let's dance, so they started. That was the concept. And it's not vulgar or related to somebody else's girl or man. It's a, I got mine, don't worry about his. The way I like it, the way it is. I mean, meantime, Ray's fine. I got mine, don't worry about his, you know.
Was anybody worried, either your producers or disc jockeys, about playing a record with the word sex actually in it?
James Brown was a producer, so it wasn't no problem.
Okay. Here's Sex Machine, recorded in 1970.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing.
Go ahead, go ahead.
I want to get into it, man, you know.
Go ahead.
Like a sex machine, man.
Yeah.
Moving, doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Can I count it off?
Go ahead.
One, two, three, four. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Machine.
Get on up,
get up,
get on up,
stay on the scene,
get on up,
like a sex machine,
get on up,
wait a minute, shake your arm, then use your palm, stay on the scene, like a sex machine, you got to have the feeling, sure as your bone, get it together, right on, right on, get up,
get on up,
get up,
get on up.
Ha!
That's James Brown. He has a new memoir called I Feel Good. How did you learn to dance and specifically to do splits?
Well, I guess all I come from playing baseball.
Wait a minute. Most baseball players do not do splits.
Well, now they don't. But those years, Jackie Robinson, the first black man, came to Major League Baseball. And he was doing the split on first base. There was another black baseball team called the Indianapolis Clowns. And the Kansas City Monarchs before black, there was the Negro Leagues. And eventually when Robinson got into Major League Baseball, he brought some of those traits with him. You know, we miss so much because had those black men had been able to play baseball then, it would be like the coaches today. 90% of all the players are black.
So you first, I think, danced when you were a kid, and you danced on the street for pennies.
I danced to pay the rent for the soldiers.
Tell us about some of those hardships, about what life was like when you were very young. James Brown, your mother left when you were four, I think, and you lived
yes,
with an aunt. What was the house like?
Well, it was very, very hard. I didn't have a place because my mother left, and my dad took me to see my grand-aunt, great-aunt. And he was his grand-aunt. She raised me, kind of babysitted me, but my daddy did basic menial work that didn't have any skill about it, but they had to go all over the country to find work, like somewhat like they're doing now. Having to find a place that common labor can make it. That's when I tell the kids to get an education today, because we never know what's going to be up there for you, and if there'll be anything for you. So it takes character and the contents of the character, like Dr. King said.
James Brown speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. A new movie about him called Get On Up is in theaters today. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Guardians of the Galaxy, the newest entry in the big-budget Marvel action movie franchise. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The newest film adaptation of a Marvel comic is Guardians of the Galaxy, which features five motley warriors against an armada of space villains. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
In the late 80s, when Batman, directed by Tim Burton, came out, most of us expected something campy and lightweight like the TV show. But Burton, following graphic novels by the likes of Frank Miller and Alan Moore, went more real with it. Batman became a tortured soul, and suddenly it was as if the god of cinema said, "Let there be dark," and lo, superhero movies became grim and dystopian, to the point where Superman, the Hulk, Captain America, and the rest had to suffer the torments of the damned to bring down one lousy bad guy. The latest mega-budget Marvel Comics picture is Guardians of the Galaxy, and it's amazingly light, funny, hilarious even, though it does open with the mom of a boy named Peter Quill dying of cancer, because you need primal trauma to give the heroics emotional heft. After that, it's blithe sailing through the galaxy. It's also, for a long time, incoherent, but you could hire an 11-year-old who wants to see it for the fourth time to explain what's happening. Peter Quill gets spirited away by space pirates. It's like sci-fi Gilbert and Sullivan, and grows up to be a wisecracking smuggler and ladies' man, played by the agreeably silly Chris Pratt, who travels with an old-fashioned mixtape of 60s and 70s hits bestowed on him by his mom. Quill finds an orb with world-destroying power that causes a lot of stress among computer-generated aliens and actors with much latex. I could spell out the hierarchy of villains with names like Yandu Udonta and Korath or various Xandarian meddlers, but it's best to focus on our five Guardians of the Galaxy, who fight among themselves before joining hands. The one you'll remember is Rocket, a genetically enhanced raccoon with the voice of Bradley Cooper, a greedy, smart-mouthed, rodent action hero in a live sci-fi epic is something you can't believe you're seeing, and is all the more to be cherished for it. He has a soulful, Chewbacca-like sidekick, a living, mutating tree named Groot, which is a name you remember because all he can say is, "I am Groot," though the variations in pitch and emphasis by gravel-voiced Vin Diesel would make Robert Frost smile. On the other hand, Zoe Saldana, as Gamora, green warrior of uncertain loyalties, has a voice with virtually no inflection, but a body flexible enough to compensate. Last to join is Drax, an intricately tattooed baldy with a bone to pick with supervillain Ronin. He's played by former pro wrestler Dave Bautista, with a mixture of thickness and melancholy that evokes fond memories of Anthony Quinn. After Drax prematurely engineers a battle with Ronin and loses big, Gamora, Rocket the Raccoon, Quill, Drax, and Groot tangle over their next strategy.
We have to stop Ronin.
How? I have a plan.
You've got a plan?
Yes.
First of all, you're copying me from when I said I had a plan.
No, I'm not. People say that all the time. It's not that unique of a thing to say.
Secondly, I don't even believe you have a plan.
I have part of a plan.
What percentage of a plan do you have?
You don't get to ask questions after the nonsense you pulled on Nowhere.
I just saved Quill.
We've already established that you destroying the ship that I'm on is not saving me.
When did we establish?
Like 3 seconds ago!
No, I wasn't listening. I was thinking of something else.
Oh.
She's right. You don't get an opinion. What percentage?
I don't know. 12%.
12%?
That's a fake laugh.
It's real!
Totally fake.
That is the most real, authentic, hysterical laugh of my entire life, because that is not a plan.
It's barely a concept.
You're taking their side?
I am Groot.
So what? It's better than 11%. What the hell does that have to do with anything?
Thank you, Groot. Thank you. See? Groot's the only one of you who has a clue.
Seriously, folks, hearing those lines from a raccoon? Bliss. Another of my favorites is the villainess played by Doctor Who's former Scottish sidekick, Karen Gillan, who's bald and blue and strides around with regal insolence. Throw in John C. Reilly as a goofy cop and Glenn Close as the Xandrian president with a hair helmet looking like something Marie Antoinette's stylist devised after dropping acid, and it's a high time at the old multiplex. Even if director James Gunn doesn't hit every one of his marks, he's a jolly ringmaster. The question hangs for me whether these movies are worth doing given how their budgets soak up Hollywood studios' capital, leaving relatively little for films not leading to so-called franchises. The answer is no. Junky sci-fi should be a part of a studio's portfolio, not the be-all and end-all. Still, given that, if you have to see one big-budget effects-laden behemoth this summer, where else will you see a raccoon and a tree piloting a spaceship?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.B. Nesper. John Myers directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculli. Wait a minute, look here.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Mira, publisher of The Good Girl, a debut psychological thriller novel from author Mary Kubica, available now. From Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort, offering European cruises on Viking longships. More at vrc.com/radio. And from Subaru, featuring the all-new Subaru Legacy. It's not just a sedan. It's a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. This is NPR.
This morning when you came in my room, I was practically naked and you didn't look at my body once.
On the Showtime series Masters of Sex, actress Allison Janney's character is married to a closeted man. She's nominated for an Emmy for that role, and another for her performance in the CBS sitcom Mom. She joins us on the next Fresh Air.